tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Sarah Williams reporting. Turkey says it has shot down an aircraft of unknown nationality that had intruded into its airspace near the Syrian border. Turkey's military said in a statement the plane ignored three warnings before Turkish warplanes shot down the aircraft Friday. Turkish broadcaster NTV reported that the aircraft was a drone and was brought down about 3 kilometers inside Turkish airspace near the Syrian border. An unnamed U.S. official told Reuters they believe the drone was a Russian aircraft. However, the Russian Defense Ministry said all its planes in Syria had safely returned to base and all its drones were operating as planned after Turkish officials announced the shootdown. Turkey has in the past shot down Syrian jets and helicopters for violating Turkish airspace during Syria's 4.5-year civil war. The Taliban has vowed to intensify attacks on American targets, denouncing as illogical the U.S. decision to slow down troop withdrawal from Afghanistan. The Islamist insurgency was reacting Friday to President Barack Obama's announcement that he will maintain the current number of American troops in Afghanistan at 9,800 through most of 2016, before trimming that number to 5,500 by the time he leaves office in January 2017.
Their mission will not change. Our troops will continue to pursue those two narrow tasks that I outlined earlier: training Afghan forces and going after al-Qaeda. But maintaining our current posture through most of next year, rather than a more rapid drawdown, will allow us to sustain our efforts to train and assist Afghan forces.
VOA News. At least three women suicide bombers blew themselves up on the outskirts of Maiduguri, Nigeria, killing at least four people and themselves. The explosions at dawn Friday were carried out just hours after two suicide attacks inside a mosque also in Maiduguri, the capital of northeastern Borno State, killed at least 30 people. According to Nigerian national emergency officials, the blasts in the mosques were timed so that the second one killed many people who had gathered to offer help after the first blast. Dozens of people were also wounded in the explosions. The Israeli army reported Friday a Palestinian man posing as a journalist was shot dead after he stabbed and wounded an Israeli soldier outside the West Bank settlement of Kiryat Arba. The knife attack occurred while demonstrators threw stones at the Israeli troops. The man, disguised in a fluorescent yellow vest over a T-shirt marked Press, was allowed to approach troops. News photos posted online show him clutching a knife and attacking a soldier before he was shot dead. The Foreign Press Association in Israel branded the attack as a deplorable, worrying development and a violation of press privilege. Hungary says it will close its border with Croatia at midnight Friday to contain the flow of thousands of migrants arriving daily in the country before traveling to northern Europe. Hungarian Foreign Minister Peter Szijjártó made the announcement after a meeting of the National Security Cabinet. A fence along its border with Croatia has already been built. Szijjártó told reporters that Hungary will continue to enforce the sanction-free travel rules on the border with Croatia, and crossings will be processed through official border posts. He said that Budapest had informed its border countries and beyond about its decision. Hungary sealed the border with Serbia in September with fences. Meanwhile, the European Union states approved an action plan with Turkey in hopes of easing the flow of migrants to Europe. Reporter Henry Ridgewell.
So I think the acuteness of the problem has been recognized by all European leaders, and they've reached the realization that Turkey really is key to solving this crisis, to trying to prevent so many people coming through. 600,000 of those migrants have come through Turkey, most of them over the Mediterranean Sea to the Greek islands. And so the idea behind Europe's plan is to aid Turkey and to encourage Turkey to stop those migrants from leaving.
South Korean President Park Geun-hye will be meeting at the White House today with U.S. President Barack Obama. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiyas Wuhib.
And coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight, more than 35 people have died in multiple suicide bombings in Nigeria in the last 30 hours. And Scottish authorities seek to interview two new suspects in the bombing of a Pan Am flight that crashed over Lockerbie, Scotland 27 years ago.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Douglas Mpuga sitting in for Sunny, music from Liberia, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, the UN Refugee Agency warns that Greece cannot cope with the flood of refugees and migrants landing on its shores because it lacks proper reception facilities to register and screen them. Lisa Schlein reports from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
The UN Refugee Agency reports refugees and migrants are arriving in Greece at a much faster rate than they can be processed. And this, it says, is increasing tensions, violence, and chaos. The UNHCR says a violent flare-up in a crowd on the island of Lesbos Thursday forced its staff to be evacuated briefly from a registration site. It says this was going on while thousands of refugees and migrants were arriving by sea from Turkey. The agency says an upsurge in sea crossings over the past couple of days has increased the death toll. In one incident, authorities report seven people drowned following a collision between a smuggling boat and a Greek Coast Guard vessel. UNHCR spokesman Adrian Edwards says much of the turmoil could be avoided with the establishment of proper facilities to process the thousands of desperate people arriving in Greece.
The disturbances there have been over the last couple of days, the inability to deal with these large numbers of arrivals, the continued problems we're seeing there, some people walking across Lesbos to try and get around the problems there, and then moving on through Europe. This is not a crisis that at the moment is being adequately managed. The facilities that have existed to date haven't been adequate to cope with the numbers. Many people go through without being fingerprinted. Many people move along this journey without the basics of dealing with large refugee and migrant population movements being in place. And that's what needs to change.
The UNHCR reports more than 100 people have died making the crossing from Turkey to Greece this year, while more than 3,100 have perished across the Mediterranean as a whole. So far this year, it says more than 450,000 refugees and migrants have arrived by sea in Greece, putting enormous strain on local communities. The European Union has agreed to establish reception centers in so-called hotspots, such as Lesbos. Until now, it has failed to do so. The UNHCR says it is absolutely urgent and essential to establish the centers to properly manage and assess people to see who is in need of asylum and who is not. It says a proper registration process also is essential for the success of a planned relocation of 160,000 refugees, mainly from Syria, Afghanistan, and Iraq, among the European Union's member states. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Incidents of human rights violations are increasing as police along Europe's external borders struggle to control the increasing flow of Middle Eastern and African migrants entering Europe. The Bulgarian Interior Ministry says a migrant from Afghanistan died as a result of wounds suffered when police fired on a group of migrants crossing the Turkish border yesterday night. It's the first report of a fatal shooting by authorities in the EU's migrant crisis. Boris Cherikov, the representative of the UN Refugee Agency in Bulgaria, says the agency is deeply shocked by the incident and criticized countries that are erecting barriers to the migrants. More than 700,000 migrants have entered Europe this year. He said the UNHCR is convinced that barriers, fences, and police forces cannot solve the problems of people who are in a desperate situation.
And Yehias, in related news, Greece is investigating charges made by more than 20 migrants that police robbed them as they crossed into Thessalonica and forced them back into Turkish territory. Greek authorities who are investigating the charges. A court in the Spanish enclave of Ceuta in Morocco ruled that 16 police officers firing rubber bullets and smoke canisters at 15 migrants in February did not contribute to their deaths. The migrants were trying to swim to shore and were fired on in the water. A Ministry of Interior video of the incident was shown in the courtroom.
And Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is mocking European efforts to prevent further flows of migrants from Syria, Iran, and Afghanistan. German Chancellor Angela Merkel is heading to Ankara to meet with Mr. Erdogan on Sunday about an EU plan to help Turkey register and house more than 2.5 million refugees now in Turkey. Erdogan says there are 2.5 million refugees, but that no one cares. He said Turkey is far ahead of most EU countries, which he said were not sincere. The discussion is likely to include Turkey's lengthy quest for EU membership.
And it's 11 minutes past the hour. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Well, what drives conflict and terrorism in today's Africa? How much impact do the Middle East and North Africa have on this trend? And what do leaders need to do to reduce the threat? A new report by one of Africa's premier think tanks looks at what drives terrorism and concludes that it is not always what you would expect. Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
The growing trend of terrorism and extremism in Africa has many powerful forces behind it, says analyst Yaki Siliers, who heads the Institute for Security Studies in Pretoria, South Africa's capital. But, he says, the most powerful driver of international terrorism is a controversial one. It is, he says, America.
Deliberate or not, the main drivers of international terrorism today is the policies and actions of the United States and its Western allies. Let's be clear, in Kenya, Nigeria, and many others, the response of the government and its security agencies to international acts, to terrorist acts, have worsened the problem. But the main source of refugees and instability are from Somalia, Syria, Libya, Iraq, and Afghanistan. These are all, without exception, countries that have been targets of US intervention. And this has led to devastation, chaos, deteriorating domestic security, and extensive displacement.
That is the confrontational conclusion of Siliers' new research into the well-documented rise of terrorist groups in Africa in the past decade. It also, he notes, could serve as a timely warning, as the U.S. this week deployed 300 troops to the West African nation of Cameroon to join the fight against Boko Haram militants. But, he says, African governments are also to blame. Boko Haram, after all, started in northern Nigeria and was initially spurred by grueling poverty, inequality, and poor governance in that area. Somalia's Al-Shabaab group started in 2006 as a local political army, before rising to the East African terror juggernaut it is today. And, says Siliers, the world's most famous terror group, Al-Qaeda, also had local origins.
When I speak of these big trends and external developments, it is always important to make the point that all terrorism is ultimately local. It is rooted in local history, in marginalization, in poor governance, lack of opportunity, mobilization, and leadership. Like bin Laden, who took up arms because of the corruption and excess in Saudi Arabia, terrorists in Africa take up arms primarily and firstly because of local challenges, not international issues.
What advice does this leave for African governments that are struggling to fend off extremists? The main solution, Siliers says, is both simple-sounding and incredibly difficult to pull off. Clean up the government, increase employment opportunities, improve education and social services, and make life better for all. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Today, October 16th is World Food Day. It marks the founding of the UN Food and Agriculture Organization 70 years ago, following World War II. The day is observed every year to raise awareness about ongoing hunger and poverty. VOA's Jody Capua reports.
The theme for this year's World Food Day is social protection and agriculture, breaking the cycle of rural poverty. It's in line with the FAO's new State of Food and Agriculture report that called for sustained private and public investments and social protections for the rural poor. A ceremony marking World Food Day was held at the Milan Expo site. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon reiterated the goal of eradicating hunger by 2030.
Hunger is more than a lack of food. It's a terrible injustice, unfairness, and inequality. We are here today to pledge again to achieve food security for all the people around the world, to build a global movement to end hunger. This will go hand in hand with a greater health, economic development, and social inclusion for individuals and societies.
Food and Agriculture Organization Director General José Graziano da Silva praised the vision of the founders of the UN agency in 1945.
There is enough food to feed all. Let us thank those who have made this amazing achievement possible. We want to thank farmers, fishermen, foresters, and all those who work in the food system. They assure our survival and protect the fragile natural resources on which humanity depends.
But Graziano da Silva says despite there being enough food for all, nearly 800 million people around the world go to bed hungry each night.
Chronic hunger and famine are the worst manifestation of malnutrition. This is the greatest injustice of our time. Many in our world of plenty still cannot live with health and dignity and die early because of their hunger.
The FAO chief said good nutrition spurs economic growth, peace, and stability. A message from Pope Francis was read at the World Food Day ceremony. Monsignor Fernando Chica Ariano, the Vatican's observer to the FAO, spoke through an interpreter.
We are living in a time where the desperate search for profit, the focus on individual interests, the effects of unfair policies hinder national initiatives or hamper effective cooperation by the international community. Therefore, much remains to be done with regards to achieving food security, which is still a distant goal for many people.
International Fund for Agricultural Development President Kenyayo Nwanze says Europe's migrant and refugee crisis highlights the need for social protection.
Thousands of fathers and mothers are putting their children and their lives at risk because the dangers at home seem greater than the dangers of the sea. Every day, thousands of children, women and men walk across deserts and mountains looking for security in a new land.
And Nwanze says the conditions that compel people to flee their homes are also the conditions that trap people in rural poverty.
Conflict, hunger, poverty, inequality, poor governance, persistent indignity, and a lack of opportunity. Addressing these conditions will require sustained and consistent investment in development.
World Food Program Executive Director Ertharin Cousin agreed.
People seek refuge or migrate to other lands, to other countries, when there is no opportunity, no food, and no hope at home. We must provide that peace and that hope that so many are seeking.
Cousin called on everyone to join together to build one world with a brighter future and to end hunger forever. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehiz Wuhib, 19 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. The UN Refugee Agency warns that Greece cannot cope with the flood of refugees and migrants landing on its shores. Today is World Food Day. It marks the founding of the UN Food and Agriculture Organization 70 years ago. And more than 35 people have died in multiple suicide bombings in Nigeria in the last 30 hours. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
In more news around the continent, more than 35 people have died in multiple suicide bombings in Nigeria in the last 30 hours. Hospital sources in Maiduguri say 29 died when two suicide bombers attacked a mosque late yesterday. Police say the death toll is 14. A local civilian defense force fighter told a German news agency 42 died in the mosque attack. The National Emergency Management Agency says this morning a third suicide bomber killed six civilians and wounded 17. All three explosions occurred in suburbs of Maiduguri, the capital of Borno State in northeast Nigeria. Maiduguri is a frequent target of suicide bombings and attacks by armed gunmen. The city is a birthplace of Boko Haram, a militant group whose insurgency has led to the deaths of more than 2,000 civilians and military and the displacement of 2 million civilians in Nigeria's northeast.
Scottish authorities have requested permission to enter Libya to interview two new suspects in the bombing of Pan Am flight that crashed over Lockerbie, Scotland, 27 years ago. The explosion resulted in the deaths of 270 people, all passengers, crew members, and 11 residents of the town. More than 180 of the passengers were Americans. The Scottish Crown Office would not publicly identify the two new suspects, but says they were named in the letter of request sent to officials of the National Congress Party that currently rules a portion of Libya. A U.S. Justice Department spokesman says U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch met with Scotland's chief prosecutor in Washington last week on the investigation. As a result of a lengthy investigation by the U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigation and Scottish investigators, one suspect was convicted 14 years ago and sentenced to life in prison. He was later released for health reasons and protested his innocence up to the day 3 years ago when he died of cancer. A second suspect was found not guilty by a Scottish court.
Guinea completed its second ever democratic presidential election last Sunday. But many Guineans, along with international observers, say much work remains to be done on how Guinea holds elections. Chris Stein reports from the capital, Conakry.
Preliminary results from 22 prefectures released by Guinea's Electoral Commission show President Alpha Condé in the lead over his challengers. Guinea's opposition has already alleged fraud and called for an annulment. Two major parties have withdrawn from the electoral process entirely. International observers from the European Union said they had not seen fraud in the election, but they complained about a number of irregularities in the vote, such as delays in opening the polls and disorganized voter rolls, both of which caused long waits for voters. People in Conakry echoed those views. Student Ishmael Silla says he has only about 80% confidence that his vote counted. Silla says he knows many people that didn't receive their voter cards before the vote. At his voting station, people were waiting to cast ballots until 9 o'clock in the evening. Hotel keeper Silla Fatimata said this vote was a disappointment compared to the 2013 legislative elections, which she says were better organized. During last Sunday's elections, Fatimata says some people had not received their voting card, so it was not easy to vote. Next time they do this, she wants the Electoral Commission to be better prepared, so this doesn't happen again. A spokesman for the country's Electoral Commission was not available to comment on Friday. In its preliminary assessment of the vote, the European Union said officials of the ruling Rally of the Guinean People Party, or RPG, used state resources during their campaigns, a violation of the electoral code. The opposition has also accused Condé of handing out money to buy votes. A spokesman for Condé's party, Ahmed Traoré, says handouts are expected of the president when he visits communities, but none were substantial enough to sway voters.
When he visits the communities, he gives envelopes. That envelopes cannot buy the brain, cannot buy the volunteer, cannot buy the conviction of the people.
The elections could get messier still. The opposition is expected to call for demonstrations and perhaps challenge the results in court if Condé wins. Chris Stein for VOA News, Conakry.
African states have converged on Tel Aviv to learn Israeli techniques of water management. Israel is in a desert but manages its water to ensure adequate supplies for agriculture and home use. Many African countries that have enough water lack the ability to get it where it is needed. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from the Israeli farming village of Netiv Hasara.
74-year-old Ovadia Keda tells African farmers and students he has been able to raise flowers and vegetables in Israel's southern desert village of Netiv Hasara on the boundary Gaza.
We use a system which we call drip irrigation system, which loads water through a pipe underneath the plant and down on the soil. You can see black pipe with a special walls which supply the water with the nutrient. And the nutrient come by pumping through the system, and it came proportional to the quantity of water that we supply.
Yaakov Poleg, director of Israel's Center for International Agricultural Development Cooperation, SINADCO, says his country, though small, narrow and semi-arid, with most of its land either desert or mountain, has been able to make its small quantity of surface and underground water sufficient for farming. Pollock says they are also showing the African visitors how 90% of the water used in towns is recycled for irrigation schemes.
We take them to see the farms. We want them to get acquainted with the problems of farmers, because, you know, farmers are farmers everywhere, and they all have to overcome so many problems. Israel is far from being an optimal country for agricultural production. Half of the country is desert. The other half is hilly. Yet, we are self-sufficient in fruits, vegetables, poultry. We are number one in the world in milk production. We no longer suffer from water shortage. It's quite fascinating.
Farmer Silvanos Malungo from Angola says he will use the knowledge gathered in Israel to increase food production in his country, blessed with natural resources, but still not able to feed all its citizens.
We have everything in our country. We have natural conditions, we have water, we have land. But the problem, we have a strategy to do this kind of work that man is doing with the 30 grams of seeds. He can take 120 tons of tomatoes. This is very, very good. I think we in Africa, we have to make a kind of partnership.
Only 20% of Israel's land area is arable, but the small state of 8 million people is a leading exporter of fresh produce and the most advanced agricultural technologies. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Netiv Hasara, Israel.
This is African News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Time in Africa,
your connection to the best Pan-African music. Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, inviting you to join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
This one, this one,
every show brings you the best music from across the continent. Old songs you know and love, and new songs to discover. You'll meet artists, too. Listen to Africa's superstars and rising stars in exclusive, unplugged interviews on the radio or on my YouTube channel. Search for Heather Maxwell, Music Time in Africa. We play only the best right here on VOA Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America, and up next is sports. And it's time now for the sunny side of sports with the mighty, mighty Douglas Mpuga sitting in for Sunny Young. Happy Friday, Douglas.
Happy Friday, Kim.
What's on tap today?
Well, Kim will take off with athletics. Thank you very much. The Portuguese capital of Lisbon will this Sunday host two IAAF Gold Rebel road races on the same day, the Rock and Roll Marathon of Lisbon EDP and the Rock and Roll Half Marathon Vodafone RTP. For the half marathon, organizers have assembled a field containing more than 10 runners with personal bests faster than 1 minute, 1 hour. All of them will be aiming to beat the 1 hour 19 seconds course record set in 2013 by Wilson Kiprop. Bernard Koech leads the entries, although his 58.41 personal best was set on San Diego's downhill course, it still makes him the third fastest man in history under any conditions. He has run faster than an hour for the distance on four other occasions, including a victory at the 2013 EDP Half Marathon of Lisbon. Fellow Kenyan Alex Koroi Oleptiptip is also in the field. He finished fourth in this race last year, but recently improved his personal best 59.28 when finishing second in Copenhagen last month. Asedu Segai is one of two strong Ethiopian runners. He set a national record of 58.47 in Prague 3 years ago, but hasn't raced since, finishing seventh at this year's IAAF World Cross Country Championships. He'll be joined by compatriot Guya Adola, the World Half Marathon bronze medalist. Bahrain's Shuni Dechasa, who finished fifth in the marathon in this year's World Championships, will contest his half marathon since winning the Arab title over the distance in April of this year. Geoffrey Kasuru, the fastest Ugandan man over the half marathon, with his 59.43 clocking in the Rome Ostia race earlier this year, is also in the field, along with Eritrea's Nguse Amlosom, who came within 16 seconds of his personal best when finishing third in Zhangzhou earlier this year in 59.55. Others in the field include Brazilian twins Paula and Louis Paula, Russian European marathon bronze medalist Alesky Renkov, Ukraine's Oleksandra Shiktovsk, Kenya's Elijah Sharem, and Eritrea's Mehawi Kasete. The women's field is just as loaded as the men's, with world marathon champion Maya Dibaba leading the entries. The Ethiopian has won four of her past six marathons, including the World Championships in Beijing, the 2014 Chicago Marathon, and the two most recent editions of the Xiamen Marathon. Morocco's Malika Ashasha, Kenya's Purity Changmwonye, and Ethiopia's Beshadu Bekele will also take to the marathon start line on Sunday.
Voice of America, VOA, Washington.
Now for more sports news, let's go straight to Johannesburg, South Africa, and join Daybreak Africa's Amaka Uma.
We begin with football. Defending champions Nigeria start their title defense against the United States of America in Group A action at the FIFA Under-17 World Cup in Chile's capital Santiago tomorrow Saturday. Guinea face England in Group B in Coquimbo as Mali encounter Belgium in Talca on Sunday. Meanwhile, the Liberian head of state, Elaine Johnson Sirleaf, welcomes to her executive mansion in the capital Monrovia the Liberian national team, the Lone Stars, today Friday. She is set to congratulate the Lone Stars for surmounting their first hurdle in their 2018 FIFA World Cup qualifying campaign. Liberia eliminated Guinea-Bissau 4-2 with a 3-1 return leg triumph away from home in Bissau last week. Earlier on, my colleague James Batty spoke to the Liberia Football Association president Musa Bility, who has the details.
Yeah, no, it was an important victory. We never had an away win for over 14 years. We hope that this is the beginning of a new age in Liberian football. We're very happy.
What do you think contributed to that? I mean, it seems to me the Lone Star is doing very well.
Yeah, we have a good coaching staff ahead of our coach, Gila, and the FA is supporting them, and the government is supporting us, so everything seems to be falling in place.
You mentioned the government is supporting the team. President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf congratulated the team on Thursday. How does that make you feel and the players?
Oh, we feel very happy. We are very proud to be commended by the head of your country. That's a point of joy for every athlete.
So what's next for the Lone Star?
We're preparing now to go and face Agricos on the 14th of November in Monrovia. That will be our biggest test so far.
That was Musa Bility, the Liberia Football Association president, speaking in Monrovia, Liberia. In athletics, Kenya's two-time world marathon champion Abel Kirui seeks to revive his career when he competes at the Amsterdam Marathon in the Netherlands on Sunday. He last completed a marathon when he placed sixth at this race last year. Finally, in rugby, South Africa play Wales in the Rugby World Cup quarterfinals in London, England, tomorrow Saturday. They are the only African team among the eight quarterfinalists.
Thank you. That was Mark Homer reporting from Johannesburg, South Africa.
This is Larry Zamuje, Chairman, Chief Executive, Sports Radio 18.9, Brilla FM, Lagos and Abuja, Nigeria. Let's talk to you about Brilla FM. It's Nigeria's only sports station. Of course, we partner the VOA. VOA! And so you can listen to Sunny Side of Sports on 88.9 Brilla FM, Lagos and Abuja. Keep listening, Africa, and enjoy Sunny Side of Sports on Brilla.
Thanks, Dr. Larry. In addition to sports radio, 88.9 Brilla FM stations in Lagos and Abuja, Dr. Larry also has stations in Kaduna and Onitsha, Nigeria. We're delighted to be your partner, Dr. Larry, so keep it sporty.
The Voice of America, VOA.
And now let's take a look ahead at the English Premier League with Downtown Brown.
It's another great week of EPL with me, your host, Downtown Brown. I'm your favorite fan. If you guys are listening, you guys are my favorite fan. If you guys are hearing me, I don't know how that works, but let's just keep going with it. First, I just want to say to all the Manchester United fans, I just have the smallest violin. If you can just hear it, put your ear next to the radio, and I just wish you can just hear the crying and the sobbing of all three goals that Arsenal had against your team. Oh, my goodness. And let me just stop that right there. Moving on, Tef is not here with us today because he is also sobbing and crying. He needs some tissue, some boohoo toilet paper. He has to go home. He has to stay in the corner still. He doesn't even want to talk to me because he knows what's going to happen. Well, first of all, Tef, if you're going to listen to this tomorrow, this is what you're going to hear. Arsenal is better than Manchester United. Facts proven. Oh, wait. Are you going to say, what are you going to say? Oh, it was the coach's fault. It was the formations we played. No, I don't want to hear it. A game is a game. A win is a win. A loss is a loss. Respect what happened and let's move on. Soon you'll play us again and maybe you might beat us. Maybe. But to all the Arsenal fans that are listening right now, grab a glass. Cheers. Celebrate. Have fun. I know it's a little late. I know this podcast is a little late even though we won already, but I just had to get that off my mind. That's the first thing I wanted to say to you guys before I move into this segment. We're going to look at some of the games to watch over the weekend. I'm going to give you predictions on what I feel, not Tef, what I feel is the right right score, right matchup, who's going to score, who's going to get an assist. So this is, you know, a little bit more accurate than TEF. Liverpool versus Tottenham. Check your local listings for the time, by the way, you guys. Liverpool versus Tottenham. I'm going to say Liverpool 2-1. And I got, you know, it's an iffy. It's an iffy on that one. Who's going to score? You can say Harry Kane might score a goal. He might score two goals. He might score a hat-trick. Harry Kane just came out of the blue. So, you know, I don't know what's going on in his head. I don't know if he wants to score on himself, score on his own team. You know, let's just move on from that. Manchester City versus Bournemouth. I think that's going to be easy win with Manchester City since you have Colin Wilson out with ACL injury. I feel sorry for Colin Wilson. He was actually doing really well in the season. You know, ACL injuries are really hard to come by and also recover from. So send a couple of prayers out to Bournemouth AFC. So hopefully he can have a safe return to the field. But Man City is probably going to take this win, a very easy win. So probably like a 2-0. Everton versus Manchester United. Manchester United is coming off a terrible defeat of, I'm not even want to say that who they lost to. I think everyone knows who. I think everyone knows who Manchester United lost to. And it was embarrassing. It was a big, bright, red gunner colors. So right now, I think Man U is probably going to have a tie since they're coming off a loss. They don't know how to handle with Everton. So hopefully they do. Hopefully they can shut my mouth up. Maybe they can't, but we'll find out this weekend. Chelsea versus Aston Villa. Chelsea is doing a terrible job on defense. I don't know what's going on with them. They're bottom of the relegation. I hope they get relegated, because if they do, your boy's going to screenshot it, and it's going to be hilarious. I'm going to send it to all my Chelsea fans and just brag them for the rest of their life. Like, hey, do you remember this? Oh, wait, what happened to you guys this year? Oh, what happened to you last year? You know? Okay, cool. They won the championship last year. That's cool. But right now, it doesn't look like at all they're showing it one single bit. And they still have players, and they just signed Pedro. I don't know what's going on. You know, Chelsea, hope you can get your heads on tight, screws on tight, whatever you guys need to do. Figure that out. Maybe come back with a win. Watford versus Arsenal. You know, as an Arsenal fan, how can I not root against Arsenal? Come on. I'm going to say Arsenal's going to win. I'm going to root for Arsenal 10 times out of 10. And that's what we do. We're better than everybody. Name one team that when we're Arsenal is all healthy can beat us. Barcelona, no. Manchester City, no. Chelsea, they got lucky, but no. Manchester United, I don't even need to say anything for that one. That's just like playing kids against soccer. Before you guys leave this week, I want to say a couple quick things. Go follow Sonny on his Facebook page. Go follow Sonny on his Twitter page. And you can also send me an email to have a shout out, or I can probably pick you guys in a Q&A conversation. We could talk about some soccer. I'll call you guys up, make some laughs, make some jokes. Hopefully you're an Arsenal fan, so you can talk to me about some great scores, some great goals, some great players. And you can email me at dbrown@voanews.com. Hey, have a great weekend, you guys.
Thanks, Downtown Brown. And just before we go, Andy Murray has beaten Thomas Berdych 6-1, 6-3 to reach the Shanghai Masters semifinals. Murray made it 9 successive games to get to 3-0 in the second set before securing a semifinal against Novak Djokovic on Saturday. While number one Djokovic moved into the last four with a 7-6, 8-6, 6-1 win over Australian Bernard Tomic. Djokovic won his last match against Murray in Shanghai in the 2012 final. Earlier, Rafael Nadal beat Stan Wawrinka. The Spaniard beat the world number 4, 6-2, 6-1 for his first win over a top 5 player in more than a year, building on his run to last week's China Open final. Nadal will meet Frenchman Joe Wilfried Tsonga, a 7-6, 8-6, 5-7, 6-4 winner over South African Kevin Anderson in the last four. And that's it for this edition of the Sunny Side of Sports. I'm Douglas Mpuga. Now back to you, Kim.
Thank you, Douglas. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Fridays, Sunny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 17:30 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, the trustworthiness of President Robert Mugabe. And next, we ask, what is the most listened to music in South Africa? But first, our own music. Here is Queen from Liberia with Sweet Africa. Thank you. Queen from Liberia with Sweet Africa.
In Zimbabwe, only religious leaders are more trusted than President Robert Mugabe, according to a new national survey. The survey conducted by the Mass Public Opinion Institute says 62% of those polled in the 10 provinces say they trust Mr. Mugabe and would vote for him if elections were held today. Ivan Chifara has details from Harare.
Conducted between 8 and 16 July this year, the survey, which polled 1,200 adult Zimbabweans face-to-face, also showed that a majority of Zimbabweans also trust traditional leaders, parliament, and their local government councils, while trust was low for the police, the Zimbabwe Revenue Authority, and the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission. Support for the opposition political parties was also low, with 52% saying they did not trust the opposition and its leaders. Morgan Tsvangirai, the founding president of the Movement for Democratic Change, is the third most trusted person in the country, with the former deputy president Joyce Mujuru coming in fourth. Tendai Biti of the People's Democratic Party was fifth, and Simba Makoni of the Don Kusile sixth. But despite showing support for Mr. Mugabe, a majority of Zimbabweans at 67% said the country is going in the wrong direction, and 90% said they feared criticizing the president, ZANU-PF, the police, or the army. For some struggling Zimbabweans like Vivid Gwede, who attended the event where the survey results were released, the results are puzzling.
I think the findings reveal a very complex situation, where they are saying that the country is going the wrong direction, corruption is rising, but they went on to say that they trust the same, leadership that is presiding over such a situation.
He adds the findings are confusing, especially since President Mugabe is the leader of the country and has failed to steer the ship from troubled waters as the economy continues to slide on his watch. Gwede said, "It appears those polled, for some reason, are not linking their suffering to Mr. Mugabe's leadership." Political commentator Fortune Gwaze said the research findings are not surprising, given that ZANU-PF owns the means of production and survival in the country.
Our economic recession is increasing the patron-client relations between the electorate and ZANU-PF, hence the high levels of trust that the people have in the president.
The latest findings are not very different from previous Mass Public Opinion Institute surveys, which have seen Mr. Mugabe lead his opponents in popularity contests. The other key findings of the survey were that 53% of adult Zimbabweans did not have a job that pays cash income, and that 81% say the informal sector is sustaining the country's economy and should be maintained. Reporting from Harare, this is Ivan Chifera.
What is the most listened to music in South Africa? Is it R&B, as in many other African countries, or maybe pop music, as in most parts of the world, or maybe homegrown Kwaito? Research by Havas Sports and Entertainment has yielded what for some South Africans is a surprising result, as Darren Taylor tells us from Johannesburg.
The sounds of American R&B superstar R. Kelly wash over patrons at a local bar. Many people here in Johannesburg think they know what the most listened to music genre in South Africa is.
I would definitely say house music.
I would also say house music, but there's also a lot of R&B and hip-hop. If you go into any club, you'd see there's a lot of hip-hop.
The most popular music that people are listening in South Africa mostly now is house, house music. The best selling is deep house.
House, and then the traditional music.
But few correctly identified the country's most popular music.
Mostly these days, people are becoming more spiritual, so they like gospel music.
The international entertainment company Havas Sports and Entertainment surveyed thousands of music lovers all over the world. It found that 13% of South Africa's population enjoys listening to Christian gospel songs, more than three times the global average of 4%. Among pedestrians in Johannesburg, the overwhelming reaction to the survey's results is one of astonishment.
Gospel.
That's pretty surprising.
I would have never expected that, no.
But music historian Evans Nechivambe says he could easily have predicted that gospel would emerge tops.
Most South Africans, they're very religious. Christians, if I may say. There's religious people, the music that they can relate to is gospel music.
He says another reason for gospel's popularity here is historical. It was used as a voice against apartheid.
Most black people found gospel music as the best way of expression of how they can tell the world who they are, you know, how they feel about their lives and what they've gone through.
In time, we'll live in peace for a world.
Much of modern South African gospel, like this track from Judith Sepuma, rails against ills such as violent crime. And as Nechivambe says, South Africans, influenced by decades of gross inequality in their society, love a good protest. Darren Taylor for VOA News, Johannesburg.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Zubair El Taib, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
October 16th is World Food Day, a day of action against hunger. The date commemorates the founding in 1945 of the United Nations Food and Agricultural Organization, or FAO. On this day, people around the world come together to declare their commitment to eradicate hunger in our lifetime. Over the past decade or so, we have seen a great reduction of people living with hunger on a nearly daily basis. Back then, about 1 in 6 people went to bed hungry most nights. Now it's about 1 in every 9. Nonetheless, that still leaves some 795,000 chronically hungry people around the world. Of these, 60% are women, and this despite the fact that most small farmers living in the developing world are women. And when women go hungry, so all too often do children. About 161 million kids under the age of 5 are malnourished. This means that their brains won't develop normally. They may have difficulties learning, and their physical and cognitive growth is stunted. Lack of nutrition compromises not only their own success in the future, but also the development of the communities, economies, and countries in which they live. In addition to those children who are chronically undernourished, Almost 5 million children under the age of 5 die of malnutrition-related causes every year. The global community is working to eradicate hunger because it is the right thing to do. The first of the United Nations Millennium Development Goals called for halving the proportion of people suffering from hunger and facing extreme poverty. We have achieved that goal. As we transition to a sustainable development agenda for 2030, we have raised our ambitions and are striving to effectively end hunger and extreme poverty altogether. The United States aids this effort through its innovative Feed the Future initiative. We partner with country governments, many universities, multilateral and non-governmental organizations, transnational organizations like the UN, research communities, and the private sector to lift millions of vulnerable people out of hunger and poverty. On World Food Day, the United States reaffirms its commitment to the fight against poverty, hunger, and undernutrition.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.